Hey everyone, welcome back to the 443 Security Simplified. I'm your host, Mark LaLiberty, and with me today in this post-apocalyptic wasteland is...
The Rick Grimes of the cyber apocalypse, Corey Knockreiner.
On today's episode...
He's a survivor, right?
For now.
Probably.
On today's episode, we are going over our 2019 security predictions, which have taken a bit of a dystopian twist.
Yeah, we go a little dark, I think.
Yeah. But, you know, it's all fun. So we survived the apocalypse. And in this episode, we'll go ahead and go over all the predictions. And with that, I guess we can go ahead and jump right in.
Yeah, I think we should probably intro why we do the predictions. I think we've been doing the predictions at WatchGuard for well over 10 years. It actually started with the old podcast, the Radio Free Security, turned into an annual web thing. But really, the predictions are kind of a fun way to share trends. And what I mean by that is we're going to share some really specific predictions, and we're really actually going to show you the worst case scenario in some of these predictions. But what's more important isn't whether or not the actual prediction hits, it's all of these predictions do have solid trends behind them. Whether our specific dystopian prediction is the truth, there are trends that we want to uncover, because it's really up to, the reason we do the predictions, it's up to us to make sure that this worst case scenario doesn't happen by being prepared for some of the stuff we're going to see on the internet landscape next year.
Yeah, exactly. And guess we can start with our first prediction, which
Why
is
not?
One of yours, and that is AI-driven chatbots go rogue. You want to explain that
one, Corey? Chatbots. Well, first, let's start with what is a chatbot. I think everyone's probably encountered them by now. You go to a site nowadays, and you might just click on the first thing on the site, and you get this helpful pop-up. Hi, I'm Susan. Can I help you navigate our site today?
Exit.
Go away! Go away! Anyways, it's a common thing on support. The site is trying to be helpful, but they pop up with like a picture of a person. They give you the impression there's a real person there. But most of the time, it's automated. Maybe some machine learning is involved as far as making sure they can point you to the right directions when you ask
what
questions.
Are you saying Jim did not help me get my auto insurance?
No, probably maybe it turned to Jim somewhere within your fifth question, but they typically start as automated things to help you out. And as we talk about this automation, it really is driven by machine learning and AI to start directing people. And the ones I'm talking about, even in the prediction, are more the text-based ones that pop up on websites, but they're going to voice ones as well. I mean, you might have seen last year, or I guess it's this year still, 2018, Google announced some upgrades to the Google Assistant. There's something called Duplex, mm-hmm. where you can tell Google Assistant, hey, make me a hair appointment for next Tuesday. And, you know, there's no online mechanism for your hairstylist. So Google Assistant actually has to call someone. So they've really automated voice calls too. And it's surprising how human they can sound.
It was fascinating and a little creepy.
Oh, it was very alarming. I think since then, some states have laws that say chatbots or bots have to announce themselves as bots first, which is a good thing. Google Duplex didn't do that in their first demo, and they were alarmingly, I mean, they even used little phrases, and the bot would while it was pausing for a second, mm-hmm. which is really unusual. But anyways, these are useful chatbots, but it's really surprising that we haven't seen attackers weaponize them yet. So one of the things I see happening is we are starting to become kind of familiar with chatbots popping up like normal, but there are sites that don't always have them, say a banking site. So we've talked about web application flaws before. If your website has security flaws, it's possible for attackers to inject other script. So this prediction is about people starting to take chatbot functionality and weaponize it for the bad. That could be finding a legitimate site that doesn't have a chatbot, taking advantage of a flaw to make a fake chatbot pop up. And that chatbot's like your trust in the site. You're assuming it's coming from a place of trust. So if it directs you to a link because you've asked a question, you're assuming that link is on their site and is what you're looking for.
Here, let me help you log in.
Yes, it could very easily be pointing to, you know, the drive-by download or the phishing or whatever it wants to do. So that's generally the prediction. What do you think about it? I mean,
it's a possibility. Yeah. I think of all of our predictions, this is one that is entirely possible for and potentially likely for next year.
Yeah,
especially with things like Google Duplex. They're not going to be the only ones working on this technology.
Yep.
I'm sure something will become open sourced or easily usable by the bad guys in this case. And we might see more believable phishing that's actually really interactive instead of just the stuff we see
and maybe even vishing with the V, which is voice calls. And by the way, if we're going really dystopian, I mean, machine learning not only is allowing computers to, whether it be through text or through voice, to naturally respond to human language, but it's also able to mimic humans. I mean, a lot of improvement over machine learning has happened in the past, you know, year. We've seen taking 30 seconds of real Obama speech, turning it into Obama saying whatever you want. We've seen something called deepfakes, which be careful looking up because people use it inappropriately too. But if you have enough pictures of someone's face, you can actually make video of them. So imagine chatbots to the next level. This is probably more a 5-10 year prediction, but not only could they use automated voice to call us for phishing, but I could actually copy Mark's voice when I'm calling Corey, and suddenly I have this whole new trust factor with the Mark I'm speaking to on
that
the phone.
That implies that you actually trust me to begin with.
That's a good point. That's a good point. I do hang up quite often. Sorry about that.
Sure. So what's our defensive tip for this one then? Be on the lookout for more potential phishing attacks that are more interactive?
Yeah, I guess there's a lot. I mean, web application security is important for the sites that do, you know, whether or not you use a chatbot. If it is the more basic text-based chatbots, web application security can prevent the injection of these malicious chatbots. But it really is about being vigilant, I think. I mean, it's hard in this day and age. Spear phishing has gotten so personalized, but you got to have a little bit of a skeptical mind everything you do online. Even I forget that half the time. We're trusting people that want to help each other, but you got to be careful.
And that's how I already have all of your passwords.
That's true.
Yep. So I guess we can go on to our second prediction now, and that is hackers cause real-world damage and blackouts as targeted ransomware goes after utilities and industrial control systems.
Yeah, that's a bit of a long,
bit of a long intro there, but there's some good meat to it, I think.
Yeah, I think ransomware targets ICS is probably the big thing. Well, there's a number of trends. I don't know if you want to start too. We have seen ransomware kind of plateauing as far as this opportunistic attack. Mm-hmm. And when I say opportunistic, you know, between 2013 and 2016, bad guys were just spamming ransomware to everybody. They didn't care if it was a grandma. They didn't care if it was a Fortune 500 company. They had relatively approachable extortion amounts of $300, which even a grandma can afford to
How
get
kind
her pictures
of them.
Back. I know. Thank you very much for that affordable. Do I get a sale on Black Friday with my ransomware? Can I get half off my extortion?
Oh, man. I just thought of a good business idea.
Oh, no. Stay with the light side. Anyways, so obviously bad guys have been opportunistically going after everyone, but that's kind of faded away. I mean, people are more aware of ransomware now. I think protections are a little bit better. And what we've seen happen just this year is much more targeted attacks. I mean, you might have some examples of some of the targeted ones.
I'd say a really good one was the city of Atlanta.
Yeah.
They got absolutely destroyed by ransomware.
I think SamSam was the one there.
Yeah. For about like a month at a time. And we've seen a lot of ones target larger companies. I haven't seen any names disclosed yet, but a lot of ransomware these days are going after companies with even larger extortions too, because they've done the
research. Healthcare is a big one too. Like, it started a few years back with the Hollywood Presbyterian Hospital, but there's been everywhere from big health centers to small ones. And when they get hit, it's not just one computer in the organization, it's many. And the ransom amount goes up to the 20K or even higher range. I think they were at one point asking millions from the city of Atlanta.
Insane.
So the point is, this year they've been targeting municipalities and healthcare, and they've increased the ransomware amount a lot. And the reason they're targeting those two is because they're kind of critical organizations. Like, if healthcare loses their patient data, it stands still for them, right? It's a big deal. So that they know not only is there a high likelihood that they might pay if they don't have an effective way of getting back online, but that they will pay much more than the $300 consumer ransomware. Same for the city, the cities and municipalities, which have been happening even on small township levels. So we just extended that a little further in that, well, what's another type of target that's a critical risk for, you know, everybody really, is public utilities and industrial control.
Yep.
If ransomware can infect, you know, the back offices of that, which, by the way, that back office often has the human interface device or the SCADA software that controls the actual industrial control, they don't have to actually infect the plant. They just make it hard to manage the plant. again, the idea is a bigger ransom because you can't have, you know, the lights going off because of WannaCry or whatever.
It seems like another opportunity for a nation state style attack, too.
Absolutely.
I mean, we've seen North Korea now linked with WannaCry as a obvious attempt to earn money.
And not Petya with Russia. Yep. In both cases, they used a ransomware, which was legitimately something spreading around consumer for criminal activity, but they used it kind of as a false flag for a nation state attack. So I think you have both factors. Criminals might understand that they could get ransom from that. Plus, it's a convenient way for a nation state to hide what their real motive would be. So possibility, hopefully we don't see the lights go off, but definitely something that could happen. And if you take anything from it, it really is the trend of ransomware is no longer being blasted to everyone. That could change, by the way. There could be a new variant that suddenly comes to everyone. But right now it seems to be going after certain critical verticals and asking for bigger amounts of ransom in return.
So what's our defensive tip for this? Turn off your power preemptively and just go ahead and get the hamster going on the wheel?
Yeah, we should go Luddites. We should get rid of all technology, assume that EMPs happened, and start to build our little caves with lots of stockpiles of food.
There we go. And in fact, if you just get rid of all your computers, then you don't have to worry about hackers. And
there you go.
Problem solved.
Well, the good news is, I mean, the ransomware hasn't changed all that much. The things that catch WannaCry and NotPetya are the same things that could have caught CryptoLocker a while ago. We're getting better with more proactive malware detection. So I think all the defense we've talked about, you and I have pushed advanced malware detection for a long time. Mm-hmm. You know, I think even the most legacy AV company has started to move away from purely signature-based stuff and doing more proactive techniques.
Don't forget backups, too.
Absolutely. And I think, by the way, we often just say backups, but for these critical systems, it's not just having the backup, it's the speed of recovery.
Yep.
So you really need to invest in modern backup systems that, you know, restoring a tape backup is actually a pretty long process.
What's a tape?
I know. Well, these cassettes that I had, I used to put a pencil in and fix the... Anyways, so definitely look into the more modern ones. Cloud-based ones or ones that actually can use fast connections to recover you quickly are probably a good idea. Virtualization, where you can reset snapshots pretty quickly.
There's a lot of backup... I can't give you the names because I don't know them, but there's a lot of backup solutions I've seen where they actually do basically image a computer over time
so
you can instantly restore
snap back to the image immediately. Yeah. Yeah. So no, heavily recommend
price,
those.
But yeah, could be very useful in the event of a ransomware attack.
Absolutely.
And with that, I guess we can go into prediction number three, which is escalations in...
Drum roll. Prediction number three.
Escalations in nation state cyber attacks will cause a United Nations cybersecurity treaty.
Yeah.
Which I think is another possibility for this next year.
This one I actually think is within the realm of possibility. In fact, I know the UN has been talking about, you know, cyber warfare like treaties in the past. I don't think they've, what do you call it when the UN does it? Is it still ratified? I don't think they've passed or ratified anything yet, but I do know that they've had meetings about it.
Because it seems like in the past few years, whether it be they're becoming more publicized or more rapidly occurring, there have been a lot more nation state attacks that we've found out about.
You know, frankly, it started with Stuxnet. I still think that's the Pandora's box, but there's been new Pandora's boxes since then. Like you mentioned North Korea. I think when this type of cyber espionage really gets unacceptable and starts to need multiple governments to come together to have a treaty is when there's collateral damage in the civilian landscape. And I think North Korea is the one that's most obviously allegedly pushed this one. I mean, when they first attacked Sony Pictures, purely a private company, WannaCry
took down the NHS, basically.
Yes, and not only critical patient stuff, but billions in economic damage for what was nothing. I mean, if you believe the allegations that was North Korea, and if it was purely monetary reasons, because they are under lots of sanctions, so maybe they're trying to get money, they only made, what, $250,000 in WannaCry
ransom?
Less than
that, I think it was like $140,000.
They barely made a cent, and yet it cost $4 billion. You know, estimated damages to businesses. And that's just unacceptable.
A month later was NotPetya, which was appears to be targeted at Ukraine, but I mean, it hit like FedEx, it hit Maersk, the shipping
company. The shipping company.
Took them down for like a week and like caused billions of damages.
And same thing. And that one was actually trying to damage systems, granted, originally targeted in Ukraine. But that kind of thing is where, you know, if nation states are doing black ops cyber espionage against each other, I may still disagree with using civilian software to do that. If it doesn't have civilian repercussions, that's one thing. As soon as you start having civilian repercussions, I think something needs to be done. I think, as you said, more of those incidents have come to light just the past year. It seems to be escalating, not de-escalating. We didn't even talk about the big one. We just got past the U.S. midterms, but election hacking, you know, whether that be direct hacking, which doesn't seem to have happened yet, or more propaganda is another thing. So I think we're just hitting the tipping point where whether or not it's really effective, you know, we can argue there's probably lots of U.N. treaties that have been countries have not really followed and not have too many teeth in them. But I do think bringing a treaty to the UN is something that will happen very shortly.
And you got to imagine a treaty would, I mean, you mentioned not having a lot of teeth, but it might at least allow retaliation at some point. Because, I mean, for now, like if you go and invade a country, it's war and they're going to attack you back. But if you go like hack their systems, right now we kind of like, you know, oh, that was bad. Don't do that again.
Yeah.
And there's no real like retaliation.
Maybe country by country, maybe, they try to sanction, but until you have the global, everyone doing it, like a sanction from one country is less effective than a sanction from a group of countries.
Right.
And I think for some things they may even allow, but this will be the scary thing. Do you allow a physical, you know, reaction to a cyber attack? And in that case, maybe there's certain cases where you should, but at, you know, it's so hard to attribute that you really want to have all your I's dotted and T's crossed before you start to allow that sort of thing.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see if this actually comes about. I mean, it does seem to be that we're really going towards that way with all the attacks that we've been seeing,
unfortunately,
over the past few years. So do we have a defensive tip for this one? Don't hack other countries?
I don't know what the defensive tip is this. I mean, my issue with nation state hacking in general is it ups the game for cyber criminals. The one thing I don't like about nation state hacking is it has been leaking. Stuxnet leaked, resulted in better malware from cyber criminals because they started duplicating techniques they saw before. We've talked a lot about the WannaCry. Eternal Blue was an NSA leaked 0-day, which upped the ability of a lot of cyber criminal malware. So I don't think any of this nation state stuff directly affects, although again, some of them are actually going after private companies, but most of the time, Russia's not going to go after your little small to medium business. But the result you have to realize that's happening is normal cyber criminal malware is getting sophisticated faster. And I think it's because of seeing some of the leaked stuff from nation state attacks. So ultimately, it just means we all have to up our cybersecurity. Right now, you know, there's no body that's protecting the world against these attacks. So it really is up to you to bring your security game up to snuff for even the more advanced attacks.
Yeah. Well, that was doom and gloom.
No, like we said, dystopian predictions.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's go on to prediction number 5 then. And this is actually one of mine. And it's, we've coined a new term, vapor worms, but really it's fileless malware will proliferate using worm-like self-propagation.
Yeah. Should you start by explaining fileless malware? I assume a lot of our listeners know, but just in case.
Yeah. So traditional malware, like the virus or Trojans you might be familiar with, drops a file on your computer and that's what it executes from.
Its goal is to be persistent.
Exactly.
And really that file's about the persistence, right?
And that file allows some AV engines easier chances of catching it because they'll scan the hard drive and look for anything that looks potentially malicious and they can catch it that way.
And they can also look for the, you know, it's not just about putting the file there, but it's putting the links, whether that be a registry entry, whether it be some cron job, something that will consistently start that file every time the computer resets its state.
These days, though, the bad guys are getting better at masking their presence, and they're using techniques called fileless malware. So in this case, instead of dropping a file on the system and then executing it, they inject directly into memory, usually by exploiting a vulnerability or some vulnerable software. Yeah. And then execute from memory. So at no point in time is there a file on your computer, which completely negates some protections entirely.
Yep.
And so instead, you have to use things like advanced malware services that look at process behaviors. and they look for...
Or scan memory directly, looking for indicators there.
Exactly. And a lot of times they start with a legitimate process that spawns off this malicious activity. So you have to be watching even legitimate processes too.
And following kind of the process chain of, you know, iExplorer launched this process, which launched this process, and oh, wait, that's bad. So really it was IE that yep. started that whole chain.
And fileless malware has been on the uptick over the last few years. I'm at a butcher the percentage, but it was somewhere between like a quarter and a third of all attacks yeah. used fileless malware.
I don't have the numbers exactly right, but Poneman Research yep. did something on the state of the endpoint security. I think in 2015, it was somewhere in the low 20%. It went to something like the higher 20% in 2016, and 2017 was all the way up to like 35%.
Yeah. And even more frightening, though, the percentage of successful cyber attacks, according to that same study, it was like 60 or 70% of them used fileless yeah. malware. So
meaning it's better for hackers.
Yep. Yeah. And so our prediction is that next year we're going to start seeing the next evolution of this fileless malware, where instead of using an exploit kit or something that the user has to interact with in order to infect the vulnerable system, it'll spread automatically, much like WannaCry did.
Where yeah, yeah.
They might have some network vulnerability that it exploits, yeah. Looks for vulnerable systems, and continues proliferating across the internet.
So it's kind of an extension of the, in a different way. Last year, we had the first ransom worm. Ransomware was very effective, and we were said, now it's going to add worm automatic spreading capability. Same thing, but more along the lines of fileless malware.
Yeah.
And I love the name, by the way, Vaporworms. Yeah. Scary as heck.
But I mean, we mentioned that it really hit with WannaCry first with this worm evolution for ransomware.
Yeah.
And that was fueled by a nation state leak, the Eternal Blue vulnerabilities.
Yeah.
And so we're probably going to need another major vulnerability discovered or leaked, which, I mean, it seems like we get one every single day almost.
Yeah, so, definitely.
Something will come along and allow this fileless malware to spread much more easily.
On the flip side, I will say there's kind of two ways that fileless malware starts. One, you said the most truly fileless technique is a software exploit. In this case, a zero day that you're mentioning, that once you have code execution, that's the launching point for fileless infection. However, there is another way fileless malware spreads pretty regularly, which is kind of ironic because it's not really fileless at the beginning. And that's Word document. That's usually documents. So there is a file that kind of acts as a dropper. But rather than that dropper downloading something that it puts on the computer, it just kind of starts a script,
usually a PowerShell script.
And that PowerShell is now at that point, it doesn't matter if the document exists anymore. You can delete that document. In fact, I bet you a lot of them delete that document to avoid detection. And then it is purely fileless. So there could be non-zero day means to still do a vapor worm
old school worms of a Word doc that infects and uses Outlook to send to your top 50 contacts and
exactly.
then, like, automatically infects them that way.
Yeah, or it's just PowerShell, it still needs some sort of zero day to do the internal spreading automatically, but it doesn't need the zero day to start the initial infection.
Yeah.
So it could be many ways. Either way, I think it, you know, fileless is blowing up, so it's only a matter of time before we have a fileless threat that actually does have worm capability.
So defensive tips for this one, we already highlighted a few of them, and really it revolves around tools that can look at malicious
processes
and watch their behavior and look for any potentially malicious activity.
Yeah, and the closest we have here at WatchGuard is something called threat detection and response. We have a host sensor that you install, plus it monitors your network activity, but it's not AV. It's not there trying to prevent malware from executing. Mm-hmm. Rather, it's kind of this post-execution detection where it does look at files, it does look at registry entries, but more specifically, it looks at processes and process behaviors, especially for ransomware, but some of the behaviors could be similar for other malware as well. So by paying attention to the processes, you have a better chance of catching fileless malware.
Yeah. So I guess let's go into our next prediction then. And this is nation states take fire sale attacks from fiction to reality.
This is one that I think I started, and I almost feel crazy for bringing up in the fact that I used to make so much fun of a fire sale. Do you know what a fire sale is, Mark?
From our discussions, I finally do, but I have to admit, I have not seen Die Hard 5 or whatever.
He hasn't seen Live Free and Die Hard. Yeah, Come on, guys.
Forgive me.
Go back and watch the whole Die Hard series, man. You have seen the first.
I've seen the first,
which
it's my Christmas
you like.
Movie.
Yeah. Which is crazy. You're right. It is a Christmas series. But anyways, in Live Free and Die Hard, what at the time seemed like the biggest kind of sci-fi, oh God, they've taken hacking too far from a nerd perspective, was a fire sale. And in that movie, a fire sale was essentially, it was a cyber attack, but they attacked three kind of verticals of basically our existence. I think they went after finance, they went after stock market trying to make our trust in economy and finance fail. They went after communications, telecommunications, and they went after, was it public utilities?
Transportation.
Yeah.
Come on, man. I haven't even seen the movie.
I know. I wrote the prediction and I forgot. But the whole point was they go after three pretty core systems of any, like, you know, country or state at once. But it was also kind of a smoke screen, too. In some cases, their target was none of those. It was just to sow all this confusion so that when what they were really doing was trying to siphon billions of dollars or whatever, that would go sight unseen. And at the time, you know, it just seemed a little crazy, a little too sci-fi. But if you think about it, all these separate aspects of a fire sale are starting to happen. I mean, financial systems, SWIFT. I mean, we've watched attackers specifically target banking systems. They've started. SWIFT, by the way, is one of the transaction systems that banks have been using for decades. I think it started with maybe an Indian bank that was on
Bangladesh.
Bangladesh,
I think.
Yeah, and they had a. They were on the same network as their neighbor company and no real firewall protecting their SWIFT system.
Yikes.
And the bad guys got into the bank and then they could fake a bunch of SWIFT transactions while still kind of lying into the logs so that it looked like everything was hunky-dory. So we've seen them do that. We've seen attackers kind of short stocks by sending spear phishing to key people at companies. Mm-hmm. So financial system attacks definitely exist. Communications, we just saw, I think you'll talk a lot about how communications can be mangled in another prediction, but we've seen people, you know, knock down parts of the internet at certain times. Mm-hmm. We've seen a lot of propaganda using social media to sow a whole bunch of fake, you know, fake stuff that people believe.
Say it. Say the
fake
word.
Fake news. All fake right. news. I hate to push something that some guy I don't agree with made.
Sorry, no. Just, it's fake news.
Fake news. There's something called fact, by the way. Anyways, it's pretty easy for them to poison our communication systems, take down our communication systems. And then as far as transportation, and let's add industrial control to that, turning utilities and lights off. While there's definitely been some rumored attempts, I think the Ukraine has had some power outages that were blamed on Russia. There's been some things that happened to the U.S. that haven't been fully attributed yet, but there's rumors that it happened. Our own FBI has warned us about the smart grid. There's airlines that have kind of lost their schedule due to some sort of computer mishap. So I feel like, as crazy and outlandish as it felt like in Die Hard 4 when I watched it, what was it, in the 2010s or whatever, that all the pieces are really there.
Are we not still in the 2010s?
I guess we are in 2010. Okay. It was probably right around 2010. Okay. I think the movie came out. So 10 years ago or 8 years ago or so, I think it's possible now. And it's kind of scary to think about. And as we watch, you know, some of the nation state escalations we talked about that
seems
could lead
like
to a CN or to a UN treaty, this would be a good way to do a false flag attack, to sow confusion when as a nation state, you're trying to do something else.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to watch for. What's our defensive tip for this one? Don't ride the bus.
I guess so. I mean, really, I think what we want here is we want all these systems to really focus on cybersecurity. Security and complexity don't go hand in hand. We see a lot of industrial control systems starting to do interesting, innovative things like the smart grid, like these mesh networks. Mm-hmm. We see what we call edge computing, where even the tiny little small processors that used to be part of these kind of operation technology edge are starting to get smarter. They're starting to put more memory and more compute power there because the cloud can't always keep up. And as we're doing this for innovation, I love innovation. I love some of this new technology. We really, as citizens, need to hold the people putting this technology out there to the grindstone to do security by design. You know, I don't want to slow down your innovation, but consider, you know, what this could do if we don't think about it. And that goes for the same for financial systems, who I think for the most part are a little ahead of industrial control.
You would hope so. But then again, we have banks that don't firewall off their critical banking infrastructure. So who knows?
Yeah. So I think we have to encourage a lot of the time. These are people, you know, we can't directly control, but we can vote with our pocketbook and kind of make sure the you know, and people we go to are actually providing security in the products they give to us and services.
You know how a lot of utilities have the, you can buy green credits,
yeah,
pay extra money to make sure your energy comes from solar power. Maybe we'll have like
security credits.
Where you can make sure that your energy was generated securely.
That would be a capitalist way to do it though. That's essentially the company saying, all you people that can't afford it, you're on your own. If your power goes out from a cyber attack, too bad.
I just
should have had more money, buddy.
It's a terrible idea. I shouldn't have said that.
I don't think it is. I mean, I essentially said the same thing by voting with our wallets, but ultimately we got to think about it. I hate the fact that security is always kind of this roadblock to innovation. Mm-hmm. I don't want to be that, but we need to find this happy medium of making sure we're not shooting ourselves in the foot 10 years later.
Yeah, hopefully we don't. So our next prediction, I think we have to first explain a term, that's trusted wireless environment. So we recently worked with, what was it, Miercom?
Yeah, Miercom.
Put out a report where we defined the trusted wireless environment, which are six security threats that secure wireless needs to defend against.
And the idea behind this, by the way, is we all, if you've ever hooked up your Wi-Fi, a lot of our viewers and listeners see that little, that lock sign by their Wi-Fi. And we've kind of grown compliant to see that you see that lock sign and it's secure Wi-Fi, right? We know internally that means it has, you know, hopefully WPA2, in the future WPA3. And in the worst case, at least, what's the old one that was broken?
WEP.
WEP. By the way, does WEP still get the lock?
I don't think it does.
I hope it doesn't. In either case, we kind of trust that, okay, that has at least WPA. It's a secure Wi-Fi network. Mm-hmm. But the truth is, the six attacks which you're going to get to, all of them have nothing to do with whether or not WPA V2 or V3 is secure.
Yep.
They have to do with tricks that you could do regardless of that.
And like a couple examples of these six attacks to defend against, like evil twins. So someone's setting up a hotspot to look like your hotspot,
yeah,
like a Starbucks Wi-Fi that suddenly appears in an airplane or something.
And there's no laws, by the way, really against that. Like you don't have to register your SSID. So if someone in a car copies the Starbucks SSID and literally changes their MAC address to the same MAC address as the router they've kind of sniffed beforehand, there's technically no law against that until they actually do something bad.
Right.
But we don't have anything that enforces a SSID
wireless in the way we do domains. Unlicensed.
Yeah, yeah.
Which means you don't have the rights to your SSID. Now, obviously, it is illegal to go impersonate someone and steal.
Yes, as soon as you man in the middle them and start doing stuff that's unauthorized.
Computer Fraud Abuse Act.
Exactly. So there it gets illegal. But that's the reason why, you know, there's no technical mechanism blocking me from copying anyone else's SSID. Yeah.
And then there's like another threat would be the rogue access point. So Jim from accounting going and plugging his Netgear into the wall to get Wi-Fi in his office.
Or worse yet, the guy that pretended to be, you know, your electricity installer coming and plugging a fake Dreamcast in your kitchen. That's actually an access point. By the way, there was a version of Linux that ran on Dreamcast that allowed this, and security researchers actually used a Dreamcast as a wireless network exfiltration device.
All right. I had no idea. That is fascinating. But the main threat from that, though, is it's probably not secure. It's probably an open access point. And if it's plugged into your corporate network, someone sitting in a van out in the parking lot can connect directly to your network without walking in physically.
Yeah.
So those are some of the threats that TWE covers.
Yeah, and that was the point of the TWE, was instead of just that lock sign, having some other kind of standard security test that shows that this Wi-Fi network actually can protect against the known attacks.
Yeah. And our prediction is also revolves around WPA3, which is another standard that was just adopted this year, I think, the beginning of this year was finally ratified. And it's the next iteration of wireless security, adding more encryption protections and a little more security in other ways too. But our prediction is that it's still not perfect, and that next year we're going to see a major wireless attack against a WPA3 network that leverages one of the six threats that we define in TWA.
Ultimately, I mean, all WPA3 means is when you authenticate and to a Wi-Fi network, and then when you send traffic on it, that traffic will be encrypted, but it doesn't stop the ability to evil twin that network. Yep. I mean, if someone knows your WPA SSID, and maybe they also know, you know, the password you use to log onto that network, they could set up an evil twin all the same and still have a nice secure WPA3 connection to their evil twin, and still man in the middle. So we're saying WPA3, kudos, by the way, for increasing the wireless authentication and encryption for clients, but there's still ways to attack it.
And I think my one, the one holdback from, I think, this prediction potentially becoming true next year is just WPA3
being
adoption.
Used enough. Yeah.
I mean, it took so long for WPA2 to even become readily available everywhere.
How often do businesses or consumers update there? And by the way, WPA2 is not broken per se. It's getting weaker.
You could argue that crack.
Yeah, but they have patches for that, unlike WEP, which was truly and completely broken.
Yes.
So I agree with you. Adoption of WPA3 will take time. So not sure how many people will use it.
So our defensive tip for this one is use wireless security tools that are able to stop these attacks.
WIPs, or wireless intrusion prevention, is the one. The reason that WatchGuard, by the way, is the one that launched the Trusted Wireless Environment Initiative. And the MIRCOM test really truly tests WIPs. And the one thing we're trying to point out, though, is all WIPs is not created equal. Mm-hmm. Like the technologies they use to detect rogue access points or evil twins, and then whether or not they can keep clients from them. Once you detect, say, an evil twin, that's one thing, but making sure that your clients don't actually connect to it, that you have to do some more active techniques.
Because if you get it wrong.
And sometimes those active techniques might accidentally kick clients at Starbucks off of Starbucks, which is a FCC violation. So if you actually look at, we don't want to use the whole podcast to talk about all the differences, but we have this patented technology called marker packets. And if you look at the other ways people do WIPs, they often start to add a lot of caveats about, okay, we do detection. If you want to turn on prevention, you got to be very careful. FCC violations cost money. We don't have that worry at all. Mm-hmm. We can confidently turn on WIPs because of the marker packets we add to all our traffic. So it just shows that, as you're looking at these attacks and how to detect and prevent them, look for technologies where you can actually use the prevention.
Yep. And I guess we can move on to our next prediction now. And this one revolves around, I think we're on six. And this one is about authentication. And specifically, we predict that there's going to be a major biometric hack that shows the weaknesses in single factor
authentication.
So these days, biometrics are being used more and more, not as a second factor, but as a single factor for authenticating into your phone or your laptop or your tablet, where instead of entering a PIN, now I just use my thumb. Or instead of logging to my computer, I'd show it my face.
And by the way, the top operating systems, I mean, most users probably are Windows users. Yep. And Windows Hello is all about this them moving from passwords as the primary mechanism. By the way, the password still exists, so it's still there. But they're starting to move to biometrics, whether it's a Kinect-like camera that's starting to be added to laptops for your face, whether it's Touch ID, whether it's just that Open Hello standard that other biometric vendors can move to. But my biggest worry here is we all know why this is happening. We've been seeing the quote-unquote death of the password. I think death is too hard, but we're seeing the weakness of passwords. And we're also seeing that human psychology and human nature means that passwords can never be as perfect as, you know, passwords could be a good authentication token, but humans don't use them right. And even if you are using them perfectly right, they can still occasionally be hacked. But rather than starting to do multi-factor, what I see happening in the industry is everyone is just saying, okay, fine, passwords are dead. Biometrics, they're so easy. You just look at it, you get on. That's the way to go. Let's just go biometrics. We'll be secure. We won't have the password problem anymore. Yay. But that's not the case. I mean, we've seen biometrics hacked a lot. I mean, you probably...
Gummy bears, even.
Yeah. I mean, guys melting down gummy bears to replicate fingerprints. And, you know, getting fingerprint tends to sometimes take physical access. But if you think about the OPM hack, do you remember that one? Mm. That's when allegedly Russia nation state actors got some data from US government, and many intelligence officers have their fingerprints on file. They actually stole a bunch of fingerprints. So
without cutting off their fingers?
Without even having physical access to a glass they touched, without doing dumpster diving or the other techniques you need. So biometrics aren't perfect. And the other weakness in biometrics is if you lose your fingerprints, what do you use now? I guess you burn off your fingers, you get someone to etch a new design.
Oh, lose like someone steals them, fell off.
If the OPM, if you had your 10 fingerprints on file and they're all gone, is that an effective factor anymore? Anyways, what we're really building up to is there's nothing wrong with biometrics. Mm-hmm. I actually like them. I use them daily. But they've been cracked. Even the toughest ones, like a Face ID on the iPhone, which is actually technically a pretty smart way to do face scanning that's not just 2D. Mm-hmm. It was cracked by Chinese researchers, I think, like a couple weeks after it came out. So I'm worried that we're over-relying on biometrics as a single factor, when what I think we both agree is multi-factor is the way to go.
Yeah. So something you have, whether it be your fingerprint or your face, and then some other factor.
Yeah.
Like a password or a token. Your smartphone.
Something, it's something you have, which is usually a token. Something you are is the biometric,
right,
and something you know. Don't care what your factors are. If usability is your thing and you think passwords aren't usable, use a biometric and then use maybe mobile device DNA, something about the hardware that you have as a second factor. You can combine factors in tons of different ways. And while we're talking about it, in the prediction, we're picking on biometrics because that seems to be where the industry is going. But the same is true of like a hardware token that can be physically stolen, a certificate. There's the PKI infrastructure that manages it, but once people hack into that, they can steal all your certificates. There's never going to be a factor that's a 100% effective. So I really think what we should focus on is combining them, not just picking one factor we think will be a panacea when it won't.
Yeah, and I mean, at WatchGuard, we've got Authpoint as our multi-factor solution, which does use both biometrics and tokens and mobile DNA, as we described.
Yep, passwords. And it does a lot of cool things that make it even harder, where if you try to image a phone, you know, there are ways to actually sometimes get quote unquote hardware factors if it's a more soft factor by imaging something, the software running on that thing. But we do a lot of tricks so that even if you imaged it and ran it in a virtualization system, it's not going to have the same DNA.
Yeah, so our defensive tips, I feel like we hit them, but really just don't rely on a single factor. Yeah.
As biometrics roll out and more people push them, one, feel free to use them. They really do help with usability, but realize that a biometric by itself is still a single factor and try to combine more than one of them.
Yep, and I think we're on to our final prediction now.
Oh, wow.
Prediction number 8. And this one is another one of mine, and it's a doozy.
Yeah.
And it's that attackers...
Definitely dystopian.
Yeah. Attackers are going to hold the internet hostage, is my prediction.
So this is the whole, can a cyber attacker take down the internet question, which is, I think in a past podcast, I talked about the one group of attackers that I got to see at DEF CON this year, and they actually went to Congress to testify that it was possible to take down the internet at the time.
Yeah. And this one, I mean, it's been a long time coming in terms of the possibility of it occurring.
Yeah.
It was a few years ago. Bruce Schneier, yep, a very prominent security researcher or
cryptographer,
security expert, yeah, cryptographer, published a paper where he had been in talks with a bunch of telcos about how people have been probing their systems, looking for critical points, testing their response time, testing how they respond, as a means to plan out a potential future attack. Where,
yeah,
if you know, like, oh, it takes them 5 minutes to respond to this attack, or this is a really critical point, when you go try and take them down in the future, you know how to hit them. And if they're a critical backbone of the internet,
yep,
you can take down a large portion of it.
And I think the same people, you'll get into some of the technology soon, but the people that pay attention to some of the routing tables for those backbones have seen quick changes that seem to be probes as well.
Yeah, the internet relies on a protocol called BGP, Border Gateway Protocol, that is old as time itself. And it's not actually entirely secure. Basically, it's...
That's a scary thing. It's old as time, but it's actually... Researchers have pointed out the flaws a number of times, but I think most of the security community will say that it hasn't got the attention that it should be.
No, it's basically on the honor system is how it's run right now, where the internet routers, the major backbones of the internet, advertise what IP address space they own. So they say, I own this IP block, which then trickles down to WatchGuard or Sony or whatever. And I mean, there's really nothing to stop someone else from saying, actually, no, I own that. And if you can convince enough of the routers on the internet to believe you, suddenly you do own that IP address space on the internet.
So you said there is nothing to stop. There are some things. So let's
talk
about
technical
mechanisms you could use, but let's talk about if they're used.
There's a new protocol that folks are trying to push called a remote origin validation, which is a way to validate that you actually own an IP address space when you advertise it out.
And by the way, owning has a lot to do with like registrars. The registrars are kind of tied to the internet backbone. So as they're giving out, you know, class Cs of IPv4 or now IPv6 space, I guess it's not a class C anymore for that, but they can kind of map the world to where the IP should be so that the backbone providers can.
So remote origin validation should validate that you actually own what you are advertising. The problem is only 0.1% of the internet as of right now
uses
actually uses it.
Wow.
Which means
that was based on you go to a couple of pages where you can actually see all the list of the top ASNs. That might be another acronym we define for people.
ASN, autonomous system numbers. So IP address blocks are part of something called an autonomous system in BGP. And so these routers advertise, I own this autonomous
block
system. And you've got a number that goes along with it, like 65138 or whatever.
And there's another page where you can see of the 60 some odd thousand of the ASNs out there, how many have this?
It's like 60.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Like 60 of the routers or autonomous systems out there are using this validation, which means that the other ones are vulnerable to someone trying to trick the rest of the internet into saying that they own that IP address space.
Yep.
And that's like a really a technical vulnerability. There's other ways you can take down the internet too.
Absolutely.
We saw it, I think it was October 2016, with a very bad day for my productivity when someone did a DDoS attack against a DNS hosting provider called Dyn. And they managed the DNS
for... It's weird. They're not even really a DNS. They're kind of a middleman where they buy domains for, or they manage domain space for bigger companies, but they're not even the top level, you know, registrars or anything.
But long story short, this one attack was able to take down Reddit, Twitter, parts of Amazon.com, GitHub, basically everything I go to in a
I think
day.
For like 4 hours, the East Coast you know, could not get to a significant port.
From just one attack. Yeah. And now imagine if they hit Dyn and a few other hosting providers or like the main registrars and took down their servers.
And we're focused on BGP probably in this, but what we're essentially saying is DNS is another very core mechanism of the internet. I mean, if unless you've memorized every IP for your favorite places, you're not going to get there. And even if you have memorized every IP, you know, chances are the web application uses domain names in its own code.
Yep.
So things wouldn't work right.
So it's a possibility that, I mean, we've seen bad guys potentially probing weak spots, and we know the weaknesses in BGP that are still unresolved, that there's a chance someone could try and take down the internet.
Going back to fire sale, and it may not even be the whole internet. If you want to, one way to get rid of communications is when you have a company like Estonia or the Ukraine, where there's actually very few, or there were at least very few entry points to the internet from their location, it's very easy to at least take down that country's internet while you're doing some other
literally
attacks.
Just go cut fiber and then they're dead.
Or even just target a DNS level or a BGP level flaw only at them, which is very possible because you'd know the ASNs you'd need for their country most likely. So yeah, I think this is a definite possibility. I think this could go subtly or not subtly, because the one thing with BGP stuff is we're talking about taking down the internet, very possible, but governments can also redirect the internet, right? It's not hard to use these BGP flaws to kind of man in the middle huge swaths of people, you know, and there are people monitoring this. So hopefully if anyone saw big changes in routing announcements, you know, at least the SANs, you know, daily handlers or someone would notice, I hope.
Hopefully. I mean, there have been a few instances I can think of over the past few years where some countries have interfered, whether it be accidentally or intentionally, with advertising different ASNs they don't own.
Or maybe intentionally with the accidental, oh, oops.
Yeah, I got
my bad. I didn't mean to do that.
So it is possible. I mean, whether it happens next year or a few years from now.
Oh, I guarantee. Yeah, who knows? I'm with you.
What's our defensive tip for this one then? Don't trust anything.
Yeah. Okay. Pretty much everyone, like you see here, lock yourself in your closet. Don't talk to people. I think it stands to, as an industry, we need to push more towards these the additional. Again, I already lost the
route origin
validation.
Yep.
Like
ROV.
More. If you're an internet backbone provider, you really ought to be using that. Same like with DNSSEC. You know, DNS is a big core part of how the internet works, and we still haven't really pushed out DNSSEC as much as it should. So it's just this continued industry push to get, you know, these big providers to start adopting the new security standards that will keep them safe.
I agree. And I mean, even on a smaller level, there's standards they could be adopting to prevent just IP address spoofing too.
Yeah. So we talk a lot, was it best practice 38 or something like that?
Sure.
I'm pretty sure it's 38. Right. Is it BCP?
Best common practice?
Yeah, BCP like 38. Yeah.
It's a document that it's for internet service providers.
Pop, Corey has some memory left. Oh, whoa.
We're so proud of you.
Don't have to put me in that home yet. What's Not your yet. Name again?
So yeah, this one, it really is an industry level push where we need to push our internet service providers and even their providers, so the actual backbones of the internet, to secure their systems and adopt protections that can prevent someone from taking down or at least taking over parts of the internet.
Yeah.
So
cool.
To wrap up, we're screwed.
Yeah. This is why we live in this dystopian Seattle today. That's why I'm not sipping my Starbucks in my office. I'm stuck in a cold garage with you and our interwebs machine.
Yeah.
I'm amazed you put that sucker together.
That works. This is how we are recording and broadcasting.
Although literally inner tubes. We got some.
Wait, there's a packet stuck in there. Crap.
We need to revert to, what was the RFC for the pigeon delivery protocol?
Yes.
We might have to revert to that for the next podcast.
TCP by carrier pigeon?
Yes, there we go.
So we do these predictions because you mentioned earlier, we try and go over the trends and then defensive tips to keep you safe from them. And I mean, most of our predictions this year kind of took a dystopian twist, which is why we went with this. But there are defensive tools out there to stop these predictions from coming true.
Absolutely. Every single one of these things can be diverted easily. It's just about knowing about what both state and criminal actors are doing and knowing how you have to adjust your defenses and your awareness to these things so that you can keep up with the modern threat landscape. I don't really think we're going to have a huge fire sale yet. Very possible. One day it may happen, but if we prepare for it now, the fire can be put out quicker.
Yeah, hopefully. And with that, I guess we can end our predictions podcast. So thank you again for listening. As always, if you have any questions or concerns, or well, maybe not concerns, I don't really care about that.
He doesn't care about it.
No. But how about suggestions for future episode topics? You can tweet
at
us.
Need some tips for how to, you know, skin a squirrel, since, you know, we can't feed ourselves in this dystopian future anymore.
I don't know how to skin a squirrel. Maybe you do.
Like I said, the Rick Grimes of the cyber apocalypse.
All right. Well, in that case, tweet Corey. He's at SecAdept. For anything technology related or non-squirrel skinning, you can tweet at me. I'm at @XORRO_, or the both of us at #the443podcast. And don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. I don't know if I mentioned that or not because I'm running on fumes right now. But thanks again for listening, and we will see you again next week.
Cheers.